This is a London Undone podcast. My name's Catherine Cartwright. These podcasts give you an audible insight into some curious places around London. This series focuses on the historic and at times peculiar City of London churches, their histories, features, associations, and their spiritual lives.
I'm Adie Grummett, and I'm the Education and History Officer here at All Hallows by the Tower. This church is, from all the research that we can find, is the oldest church within the City of London, within the old Roman wall that comprises the City of London area.
Right.
That makes us 1,343 years old this year.
Oh my goodness. So we're going back a long way.
We are going back a long way. There's a hell of a lot of history here.
How can you date it to that time?
Well, the founding priest and was appointed Bishop of London in 675. His sister was the abbess of the great convent at Barking.
Yeah.
And at the time of his appointment, I think she basically said, I fancy a London pad as well.
Right.
And bought this plot of land and made a chapel for the convent of Barking right here in the City of London. And the ownership of the land stayed within the Abbey of Barking for hundreds of years until Henry VIII, when it was passed over into the patronage of the Bishop of London. We do have an arch from the original stone building on the site. Again, difficult to time exactly, but I've heard 7th century, I've heard 9th century, I've heard 8th century. Now, this particular arch was lost for many hundreds of years and only rediscovered when the church was bombed in World War II and all the plaster fell off the walls and this structure was revealed as having been covered over many, many hundreds of years ago.
And we can see it today, can't we?
We can indeed, yes.
Is it at the back of the church?
It's at the back of the church underneath the organ loft. I'm told that its size indicates quite a substantial building on the site.
Yeah.
And it is, in fact, doubly interesting because all the stones in the top arch of the structure are actually Roman floor tiles. And the Saxons built in stone using what they could find to hand, which was all the old materials from the Roman buildings.
That's the oldest bit of the church?
Not quite. It's the oldest bit of a church building on the site.
Yeah.
We do, in fact, have a Roman pavement down in the crypt of a house that was on the site before the church was built, yes.
And it can be seen?
Yes.
Clearly there's been activity on this site for a very, very long time.
Very long time.
Nearly 2,000 years. Church, when you look at it from the outside, has an old exterior wall, but it looks much more modern inside.
What happened was we were badly bombed and burnt out in the Second World War.
Yeah.
The first bomb came through the east window and smashed everything up. That was a plain old explosive bomb. And then 2 weeks later we were firebombed, and that was devastating. So the vicar of the time, the redoubtable Tubby Clayton, he was known as Tubby from when he was a child, vowed to rebuild the church. And he, after the First World War, had been the founder padre of TOC-H, the International Philanthropic Society, which still exists. And he used that incredible international connections.
Yeah.
So that international network, when it came to rebuilding after the Second World War, he basically mobilised and did a huge amount of fundraising, and we have this amazing church to thank him for.
So it was his efforts that led to
that rebuilt it. What was left after the bombing was our outer medieval walls and our tower, which is Cromwellian. Again, very unusual, because nobody built in the Cromwellian era.
Yeah, so tell me about the tower then and
the
why it was built there.
In 1651, there was a local terrible accident, and a ship's chandler who had his premises built up against the church wall had been keeping some barrels of gunpowder in his house overnight, and they went up. And something like 67 people were killed.
Oh, goodness. Proper played the whole accident.
It was really awful. A great deal of devastation locally. Yeah. There's an extraordinary story of a baby in its cradle that was blown up in the air and landed perfectly well on the church roof. But what the effect of that was that it destabilized the tower of the church, okay. which wasn't discovered for about 8 years afterwards. So in 1659,
yes.
they began rebuilding the tower, which, of course, was still in the Parliament era.
Right.
So we have a Cromwellian red brick tower on a medieval stone church,
yeah.
which is very unusual
yeah.
indeed.
And then the top of the church from the outside...
Oh, yes, the spire yeah. is copper from what was Rhodesia. Again, it's one of the Toc H donations. We have steel pipes from Australia, we have wood from New Zealand, we have concrete from Canada making up the ceiling indoors. We have all those donations really are very much part of a yeah. fabric
That's
of
nice.
The church.
Do you mind selecting things inside the church that you think are of particular interest or unusual or special to you?
We have several brasses.
Okay.
And 17 in all, dating from the earliest one is 1309 to 1530s.
And when you say brasses, you mean?
They are memorial brass plates that would have been set on tombstones
yeah.
within the church. So they'd be set into the floor, they would be set into usually Purbeck marble. They've been through a lot. They too were part of the bomb devastation.
Yeah. And can we see any of them?
We can. They're all now set into the sanctuary. I suppose this is probably our most ornate one. This is Mr. Andrew Evengar, who was a member of the Salterers Guild. Now, what we can see from this is not only him standing there and his wife standing there, but their daughters by her and their one son by him.
Oh, I love this.
It is beautifully ornate with the floral background and the Latin texts over their heads.
There's a lot going on.
And is still there as well. And this Pieta.
Yes.
The dead Christ in the arms of Mary that hovers in the air between them in all the ornate flower work.
And the figures themselves, the man looks so ordinary, they haven't glamorised him.
He's got quite a bulbous nose and a double chin, hasn't he?
How lovely.
And
it's
she's sort
detailed.
Of a bit round-shouldered, isn't
yeah.
she?
Yeah. So the rest of them are dotted around the altar here.
Yes, they've all been saved and most of them have been relocated into the sanctuary. This gentleman here is depicted with both his wives. Now, of course, that was not concurrent, but I like the fact that in death he keeps company with both of them, really.
Yeah, he likes both, at least.
We get all sorts of requests to have a look at them, and we're really lucky in that we have a lovely gentleman who helps from the Memorial Brass Society who looks after them for us, comes and polishes them up and makes sure they're all right.
So there's a national body of enthusiasts or specialists.
Specialists, very definitely specialists.
Who know about these brass fixtures.
Indeed.
And they come here and look after them.
It's a real thing. It's one of the delights of my job, in that whilst I'm not a trained historian, in learning all the detail of this building alone, I've come across whole worlds that we never knew existed, you know, the world of memorial brasses. Yeah. The font cover is by Grinling Gibbons, and it is an astonishing achievement of carving.
This is extraordinary. Has it always been here?
Since 1682, it was a gift to the church, and it was originally located in the South Aisle. But it is an amazing achievement of the woodcarver's art.
It's wood.
It's wood. It's lime wood, and it is so fine. All those leaves, all those petals, incredibly thinly carved.
Yes, it's like a cascading bouquet of
fruits and flowers and foliage and it's those three little cherubs with their rather gorgeous bottoms,
bottoms.
Surmounted by the dove symbolizing the Holy Spirit, of course.
Now that is extraordinary.
Cost all of £12 in 1682.
What a bargain. I don't know what that converted to, even. Who knows? Even then, that was a bargain.
I think quite literally it's priceless. So.
Because Grinling Gibbons crops up everywhere, doesn't he? But this clearly must be his work because it's so
Well, it does intricate. Have his little Peapod signature. I think it's around the other side. We do know it's him. We have three of these extraordinary sword rests. And what would happen is the Lord Mayor of London, elected for a year at a time, during that year would be required to attend a service at every church within the city in ceremonial dress, which comprises a socking great big sword, which would be ceremonial. But of course, it's a little bit dodgy to carry weapons in a place of worship.
Yeah.
So it would have had to have somewhere special to put it. And you put the point of the sword up through the ring there that's at the top and rest the hilt in this little dish at the bottom. And there it would stay for the duration of the service.
Isn't it ornate as well?
It's beautiful Sussex ironwork. We have three here because the practice was if a member of your congregation was elected as an alderman or as Lord Mayor of London, the church itself would put up a sword rest.
Right.
For this to happen. And we had three during the 18th century.
I see. Are they still used? Is this still used?
No. Sadly, we go to visit the Lord Mayor of London now. In one of our ceremonies. He or she doesn't come to us so much.
What is that ceremony?
That ceremony is one of our rather bonkers medieval ceremonies that we carry on
Tell
with.
Tell me more.
It is called the Knowles Rose Ceremony. And again, I'm going to fish for dates in my head. I think it's around 1389. Sir Robert Knowles, who was a great favourite of the king and a hero of the Hundred Years' War, arrived back from the war to find his wife in some legal hot water. They lived just over the road in Seething Lane. And she had become very irritated by the dust from a threshing field over the road from their house. So she bought it and turned it into a rose garden.
Okay.
Very lovely.
Yeah.
And so as not to get her gown or shoes muddy in crossing the street to her rose garden, she built a little footbridge without planning permission. So Sir Robert arrived home to find this legal
disaster
going on. However, one can't really drag favourite of the king and great war hero over the coals legally. So instead an agreement was made that a quit rent would be paid annually. And the quit rent was a single rose from the rose garden.
Aww.
So every year still we cut a red rose from the rose garden. Sometimes it has to be sort of encouraged there from the local florist, but we take a red rose from the garden and put it on a cushion and process it down through the streets of London with lots of members of the Waterman and Lighterman Company in their bright red Tudor dress, carrying great big oars, and we process it all the way down to Mansion House and present it to the Lord Mayor with much ceremony and speechifying.
We're in All Hallows by the Tower. It is by the Tower.
And it is by the Tower, although a friend of mine who works over the road joked with me and said, or as we call it, All Hallows, not by very much. And I emailed back and said, ahem, technically everything else is by All Hallows.
Right.
Because we were here 400 years before that pile they call the Tower of London.
Yeah, and do you have a relationship with the...
Yes, very friendly, although not always so. The border between us historically has been disputed several times, which came to a riot in the 17th century. Our southern boundary happens to be in the middle of the Thames.
Right.
So we do get in a boat and go out and beat the water.
And in what way does it clash with, or has it clashed?
Right, well, every 3 years we reenact that riot. And having each beaten our respective bounds, they emerge from the bottom gate of the tower and we emerge from the top. And we all approach each other on Tower Hill, shouting Yarboo sucks at each other. until the governor of the tower and the vicar of the church say friendly words to each other and shake hands, and then we all have tea.
I love it. So when is the next one? Every 3 years?
It's Rogation Tide, Ascension Tide, so usually early June.
Oh, I'm going to attend that. That sounds hilarious.
Oh, it's hilarious. Oh, I mean, it's all over in 10 minutes.
Yeah, but, funny.
But it's very funny to see the whole choir and a bunch of beefeaters marching up the hill, you
shouting
know, booing and hissing and shouting at us.
I love that. That's so do you want to take me down to see the
Romans? Let's do Romans.
So you're going to take me into the Undercroft and Crypt Museum. Is
Indeed.
That where we're heading?
Yes. So here it is.
Look. Beautiful.
Now this is supposed to be the floor of a Roman house on the site. Early 2nd century, probably, a domestic house, the tesserae, the little terracotta tiles that comprise the floor, are quite plain. It's not a mosaic. And there is a sort of dip in the middle here, which either it is the site of an internal partition wall, or else it is simply a bit of subsidence that was then filled in with the Roman version of concrete to even things up. And on top of this is still our Saxon undercroft structure, in which you can every now and again see a Roman floor tile.
Yes,
and they appear all over the place. This was found quite by mistake in the 1920s when Tubby first took the church over, and amongst the things he discovered was that there was some subsidence both under the nave and under the tower. And so they sank a shaft down under the tower here to find out what was going on, and they discovered it here in the Saxon undercroft.
Pure chance. There is a mini chapel down here. Can you tell me about it?
Right, this is one of our three underground chapels. This space, whilst being very much part of the 14th century church, but this is our columbarium, and this space was created in the 1930s as a result of all the clearing out of the undercroft. But in the middle of this chapel is an astonishing stone altar, which is... Really, really, it is from Castle Athlet, Richard the Lionheart's castle in Palestine from the Crusades.
And it came here how?
Well, for a long time we thought that the Templars must have brought it back with them after the sort of rather violent suppression of the order. And then I had some old postcard images of the columbarium when it was built, and it wasn't there. And I started thinking, where is it then?
Yeah.
You don't move chunks of stone that big around. And then I was contacted by an Israeli archaeologist who told me that she was investigating the castle in Haifa.
Yeah.
Heard we'd had an altar that was supposed to be. Could she come and see it? And I said, yes, of course. And we struck up quite a correspondence. So she visited several times and has now verified without argument that it is the altar from that castle, Athlet. And it came here, in fact, in the 1930s. There was a most redoubtable female missionary called Miss E. Newton, who smoked a pipe.
Yeah.
And she'd been there for a very long time indeed, an amazing woman who worked a tremendous amount with the Palestinian and the Arab cause. And that became slightly uncomfortable for the British occupying forces. And so she was kicked out.
Right.
And she brought this altar with her.
She was
and was finally persuaded by Tubby to donate it to the church in the 1940s.
Well, this is the other little Clare Chapel. This was a burial vault, 1603, I seem to think. What is interesting down here is this very weird piece of metal on the wall. Now, when the church was firebombed, the fires were so very hot that the roofing lead melted and ran down the walls like water. Apart from all our treasures, and we have American connections, William Penn, of founder of Pennsylvania, was the son of Admiral Sir William Penn, local residence, and it was Admiral Sir William
who saved this church from the Great Fire of London.
Yeah.
He was Samuel Pepys's employer. Famously, they didn't get on as neighbours. And then Pennsylvania came about because the Crown owed a huge amount of money to his father, Admiral Sir William, and decided to pay it back by giving him territory in the New World in America.
Yeah.
So, of course, he's a famous Quaker and diplomat and one of the great thinkers. And then we also have John Quincy Adams, who was married here.
That's right.
He married a local girl, Louisa, who, again, lived just over the road in Seething Lane. And until Melania Trump, she was the only non-American first woman in history. Yes. When he was in London, travelling through France as well, that's when he met Louisa.
Yeah.
And he met her as a teenager and they married later on.
What else is in the crypt?
These amazing Saxon carvings,
wonderful,
again, were found by mistake. Most of this one, I think, which depicts some strange beasts at the bottom, possibly dogs, and a little pair of feet, and a draped robe. It's very decorative, and on the side, it's got some fantastic Celtic knotting carving. These were chunks of stone that fell from the pillars of the church when they were destroyed in the World War II bombing.
So lots of city churches have lots of different items from different churches that have disappeared over time for various reasons, but All Hallows doesn't seem to need that. It's got enough of its own
But I think what I love about this little museum is that it's not very whiz-bang or flash. It's just sort of small and quirky, and I quite like that, actually.
I love it.
It's great. Although, you know, there's so much history that springs from the old stone walls and the Saxon arch and all that sort of thing. Personally, when I come into this space, you always breathe slightly deeper when you come in here, because it has a real prayed-in, quiet heart to it, I think. I think in my more fanciful moments, I do imagine I can hear so many voices that have said their prayers or found a quiet moment here or come in to light a candle. And I really feel that presence. We've been here so very long for the same purpose. The purpose of this building has not changed in nearly 1,500 years.
And it's still used today? It's still a parish church?
It is. We have several different congregations. There's the Sunday congregation. There's a Tese service on Wednesdays, which is very well supported and much valued by many of the people who come and use this as quiet space.
Yeah.
And I think because there's so many nooks and corners in the church too, it's easy to find a little quiet space in here. And then we also have an early morning Eucharist once a week as well for local workers. And often in lunchtimes, you'll find people coming in just for a bit of quiet space.
Yeah.
Just for a moment away